Good afternoon and welcome, April 14, 2022. Thank you for joining us. Today we're talking about, we take a little break from this earth-shaking conflict in Ukraine. We take a little break. There's just a incident with the Moskva ship and more random little videos and things coming out, human rights abuses from reported by people who had lived under shelling from Ukrainian forces and looting, and a scenario with people trying to leave and being killed. A family was killed, it looks like, by Ukrainian. They formed several brigades out of prisoners. They just released like very violent offenders and made these punitive battalions. They're not useful for operations. They don't function like a military, but they put them in uniforms and throw some helmets and vests on them and tell them to shoot civilians that are trying to leave, is what's going on. Crazy, but true. This is not a new phenomenon. We'll just circle on this real fast. It's not a new phenomenon. This has the fingerprints of death squad practices. This was the stuff that came out of the School of the Americas and also Abu Ghraib, which we're going to actually talk about. And that's why it's very relevant. We're going to actually talk about how these things are related. Abu Ghraib prison, as well as Guantanamo, are places that people are transformed into killers. They're not places to keep people who already were killers. They may have been involved in something, but in the capacity that's, you know, just an enemy combatant, whatever that means. They use a lot of drugs on them, psychoactives. They scare the bejesus out of them, or rather the Muhammad out of them. They give them a lot of LSD and simulate going to hell and being given a second chance. They use a lot of stagecraft and crazy stuff. They put them basically in like a movie set while extremely out of their minds on psychoactives. And in this movie set that they're in, they get killed and they die and they go to hell. And then Muhammad or whatever comes and saves them and says, but you have to go out and kill all the infidels. And then they are released from Abu Ghraib, and so goes the story. Marina Abramovich showed Jacob Rothschild how this process works. I know this is beyond people's basic comprehension at some level, but the Rothschild Foundation financed a art show where she showed the process of cleaning one's mind, neutralizing one's consciousness, and she showed people in the orange jumpsuits in little tiny cells. And it was supposed to be about something else, you know, of course. That's how it was billed. Now, people experienced this lockdown some years ago, and some in some parts have experienced some rolling ones. And their methods are failing. They had the market research. But there has been a corruption of intelligence and of scientific research. It's really marketing that parades as scientific research. And it's one thing if you're trying to pull the wool over on investors or consumers. You know, when shareholder meeting, there'll be some presentation by some wolf, and here they'll create some story of in which direction this company should go to maximize shareholder value. And really, it's a crash and burn, a pump and dump tactic. But what happens when those business practices, because a lot of these people in Pentagon and have gone through business and business management school, and they themselves are caught up in the simulacrum. They are in their own illusion. So while they use a lot of contingency planning and they use a lot of the tools and methods associated with rational planning, there seems to be a contamination in the transatlantic elite. Now, they should never be underestimated. And they're aware of this problem, but it's very hard when the entire ethos of your civilization is anti-civilizational, when it's primarily transactional and mercantile, and what's true is what you believe to be true, this subjective theory of knowledge. This can have disastrous results when you are confronted with an opponent that engages in sober assessments. And they oversold the Great Reset and many other factors. And I'll introduce as well that there were some problems that they encountered in trying to make the lockdowns go on. And as we said, if it was the last talk, the one before, we explained how that went sideways. What got in the way? There's an inter-elite conflict, and there are elites that can see what's happening, and they can see what happens. They see the direction that things go, and there can be only one. It's like Highlander. There can be only one. And they're not in the position for that one to be them. They know that. They have 5 billion or 10 billion. 900 million. But they don't have 50 billion, 100 billion. And they're not in the club of the bigger multi-trillion dollar total asset, hidden through many different fronts and holding companies and consortia, where they use a combination of I'm talking about the ruling families, use many methods to conceal. They use combination of social power and distribution of wealth through different fronts. So just seeing, oh, so-and-so has $200 billion, that's not the... Those are important players that are the upper echelon of the technocratic management, are the people that you see as the top billionaires, the, you know, say 50, 80 billionaire plus billionaires. Those are the top echelon of the technocratic managerial elite, not the ruling class. Hi, Yever. We will assess, we will look at the formative ideas as we do. And in this today, we look at, in particular, some very important things that developed in their thinking with the, this is going to be a multi-part series. I think the next couple of days will actually be required to dissect this. The next couple of days, we'll have to look at this. This can't be knocked out in just a couple hours, I don't think. Now, we have first to understand the smart cities. And the smart cities, when I first wrote about planned obsolescence, and that ending planned obsolescence would greatly increase total wealth of everyday people, wealth not in terms of assets that you have some idea that you're going to sell in the future, and then, you know, that is going to be, you're going to increase your liquidity and then have sit on a mountain of cash. That's not, you're not experiencing wealth. It's only when you leverage that for something or spend it for something, those things are the wealth. So when I say that automation in and eliminating planned obsolescence are the only two ways that these things can work together to increase wealth, we're talking about the number or quality or existence of objects, physical things that you own in your life. Whether that's the size of your house or electronics or things like this, furniture, appliances, automobiles, these things. These things can all be made to last much longer, 10 times longer. And then with things that are like clothes, which are sort of like a function with like automobiles, the practice of interchangeable parts, both for certain mechanical parts where a genuine innovation has taken place, the fitting, typically because of the way that these things evolve, the fitting can fit with the parts you already have if the whole thing isn't made specifically to be non-compatible. The actual natural development, if you take a piece that's an improvement in a car and you improve that piece, that component, the one that you've improved actually has the same fitting. You would actually have to go out of your way, and that's what they do, to make new car parts incompatible with old car parts. They go out of their way to do that. And that made sense in the nonsense of the life work cycle, the life work employment, production, distribution, you know, money in, money out, income, and then expenditures, that whole system. Now, as we've explained, what the elites want to do is build a... They're not going to do this. I'm just explaining what they're selling, what the upper technocratic management is trying to sell to the public. And let me just say that with the sort of Bill Gates and that, and then the Klaus Schwab and Harari and whatever, and these people, and then the Elon Musk, let me just be clear. Nobody elected any of those people. And if Elon Musk is supposed to run interference and be some voice of some other technocrat who you also didn't elect, that you place faith in or confidence in, just bear in mind that he is equally unaccountable. And if they can simulate that actual constitutional, Republican, Democratic forms of governance aren't necessary because, hey, we have an Elon Musk who can criticize big tech or criticize the depopulation agenda, then you're going to think that, you know, we just got to get behind him somehow or buy a doggy coin. Now, there are different, we've explained, machinations and different conflicts within the elite. And there is certainly an angle of certain aspects of the military-industrial complex, which are behind Elon Musk, the kind of both the you know, Starlink and SpaceX, all that is sort of like what the NASA and DARPANET kind of stuff was. And that's, there's a brand, there's a power structure behind that, that wasn't exactly on the same page with the Google Alphabet, and also a different program from the CIA's, you know, different department, also, you know, Pentagon and then CIA, CIA's Facebook. We want to understand, we want to trace the genealogy of these elite ideas. Tracing whatever clubs or organizations that they belong to may be useful. If I thought that was the essential thing involved, then I would dedicate my time to investing my resources into this guilt by association method of conspirology. But I don't personally find it very elucidating. We want to understand the ideas, and it doesn't really matter where the ideas come from. It matters how the ideas are used. We will discover that it's entirely irrelevant who came up with the ideas and what their intentions were or what associations they had. And then to backronym those associations and based upon how we've evaluated how those ideas were used by other people. I mean, it's just, in my view, an upside down way of approaching the problem. It's not without merit. There's something there to see. It's not wrong information. It's just not how I analyze things. That's the beauty of having many different individuals approaching problems from many different angles. We're all the richer for it. We enhance our understanding of these complex processes. I'm just one voice of many. I have one particular angle. So without further ado, then we will jump right in and look at at this. So Michel Foucault is a critical, this is like a whole series in understanding this. I don't want to say that Michel Foucault planned the Great Reset. Okay, that's not what we're talking about. But he was a French post-structuralist theory who was some kind of scriptophile. I have five or six of his books. One of them is The History of Madness. I haven't even gotten through a tenth of it, and I think I'm over 100 pages in. I don't even know how I'm going to plan my attack on this. It's that each page is so dense. It's like a newspaper column, but triple wide, but it's so dense. And then there's 1,000 pages. It's insane. 1,000 pages of this. And now he has a book from, I think, the 70s. When was this? This is 1977 was the translation. 75 was the French edition, yes. And it's called Discipline and Punish, The Birth of Prison. It's really a sequel or development of Nietzsche's Genealogy of Morals. So you really first want to get into Genealogy of Morals to understand some of the problems that he's looking at in terms of punishment and morality and the primary... He almost writes it in the same exact style of Nietzsche. It's almost it's more than an homage. It's almost a mimicry. But he develops it even further in this Nietzschean way. And his approach is post-structuralist, which is this academic way of saying, sort of like saying post-Marxist. But his mentor, his primary teacher, was the French Marxist structuralist Louis Althusser, who was quite prolific in his own right and whose ideas are worthy of examination. And how the process happened is, of course, fascinating, but the thing to understand is that these developed this type, this whole foray of literature developed not to improve or perfect the methods of human enslavement, but rather to provide whoever could read and understand it, at least in the minds of the authors, their own view. However, we may disagree with their methods or their conclusions. It was a liberatory project in their own minds, and they were openly hostile to the corporatist, technocratic elite and structures in their lifetime. That's mostly what the focus was in many ways, at least of Althusser and Foucault. Foucault gets into the, you know, foundations of the psychosexual dynamics, and he was also a pervert. He was, you know, really liked them young. I don't know if it was criminally young or just, you know, teenage young. So he was definitely had a highly fetishistic sexuality. And at a certain point, like I said, so it's really irrelevant to try to figure out what their intentions were. But the point is that as this literature, as this stuff became canon for students in the humanities and in social studies and in the philosophy departments, these are the ideas that actually inform the ruling class's technocratic new elite ideas about transitioning into the next, what they call, and I've said, don't let them call it that, but what they call the fourth industrial revolution. And as we've explained, they're using that term to scare you from what it's actually could be, from what it actually could be. And now we have copious amounts of evidence. I mean, direct receipts, the recipes for the sauce and the sauce itself. And that's what we're going to dig into. But also, we're going to keep it interesting, not a dry approach by any stretch. But to understand, first, to understand this prison grid society that they want to build is, and what I cut myself off was about smart cities. When I first wrote, for this project of the Russian Academy of Sciences about smart cities, about planned obsolescence and the rise of multipolarity, because these go together because of the impossibility of the supply line security or the efficacy and cost effectiveness or even logistical workability of these massive, sea route transport systems from China or Brazil or Turkey into the United Western Europe and the United States, and then also with automation is the real kicker. You just don't have, and we're not going to belabor the point because it's for those who have access to the recordings of our past episodes have all of this, and we're always trying to be as to the point and economical with our time as possible. So that's available to people who support the work and can find out about that if they want the past episodes. We go deep into this. We mix it in talking about the conflict in Ukraine, and all these things are relevant, just like what's happening now with releasing these prisoners and the use of prisons to train people. This is a program deeper than just releasing random prisoners. These are programs where in the prisons, see, many of these people were prisoners, even were considered war criminals from the 2014-2015 period. And they broke Ukraine's own rules. And when Zelensky came in, they actually arrested these people. And it was one of those signs that Zelensky was serious about going after the most egregious perpetrators of war crimes that Ukrainian forces had committed against the Donbas. But it wasn't that. See, that was the ruse. Actually, these prisons were very much like Abu Ghraib and Gitmo, and actually training them to be killers. They may have been in prison, but actually in sniper school, but also being brainwashed brainwashed is an overused and too vague of a term. They were being rewired using therapeutic psychedelics, psychoactive substances, different processes. Arming these people is basically a super soldier program. Super soldier program is, I think, the in the nomenclature, if I have that right. It's not called that, but for a point of common popular reference, a super soldier program. Okay. Now, when I first wrote about multipolarity and the end of globalization and how that is contingent upon ending planned obsolescence, okay, I got about 4 dozen emails from different professors, mostly from Western Europe and the United States, who were in sociology and urban planning. And they were very friendly, but they were almost identical letters, almost like a dear colleague's letter had gone around to write me, like a dear colleague's or an email had gone out like to send me an email, because I got them all within a 72-hour period, and they were, you know, 3 dozen of these, and from different doctors and lecturers on urban planning and questions of technology, ethics, technology, urban planning, and what else? Sociology, anthropology, social anthropology. And Northwest University, Auckland University, Polytechnic University in France. And they all said the same thing. Why did you leave out the smart cities? This is a perfect solution. This is going to increase efficiency by 15%. That's a lot of that Green New Deal stuff, like remaking buildings and making the windows smaller so that they have less energy loss. You don't want... I went... One of the high schools that I went to in Los Angeles for a short time, Fairfax High, had been built, had been the new parts of the school had been built by an architect who built prisons. And the windows were about 10 inches long. Not very wide, just like 10 inches wide. From side to side, they were 10 inches long. And minimal light comes in, by the way, but it's very efficient for cooling and heating, you know, since energy is such a scarcity, is the thinking. It's totally bizarre. Now, of course, this has an effect on truancy and depression students, because of how important sunlight is, right? And I suspect at a certain level that they know this. I mean, I don't know that the city commissioner who greenlit the blueprints knew this, but you know, you have someone whose primary job is designing prisons to design this. And this is actually what the smart city stuff is. I mean, this was 30 years ago when I was like a sophomore in high school, but pretty crazy stuff. And now with the smart city, I'm setting a few things up to connect these dots, and we're going to have to connect the dots, and it's going to take us 6 or 7 hours, you know, and we're not going to do those today. This is going to be a few days. I mean, there may be some big things to talk about in the conflict as they pop up tomorrow, the next day. We might delay a few more days to finish this more historical, theoretical discussion. But I think that you will find this very useful and eye-opening. So the smart cities is really the end of the era of humanity. It's it's a way of understanding that the world and its affairs have turned upside down. You know, overnight, the elite's game plan was laid out entirely bare for the world to see. With the use of new coercive technologies, this is all Harari talks about, right? AI, automation, transhumanism. And the public has experienced the rollout of the new normal regime through a series of sudden changes, such as lockdowns or requirements for new kinds of up-to-date medical documentation in order to preserve the right of travel or of work. To get into a supermarket. Now, these are being pushed back in fits and starts, but it's losing overall. But only if you continue to push back. They want you, through this gargoyle effect, to think that their power is totalistic. They want you to think that this whole central casting of these disgusting characters, these fear-inducing disgusting characters that vibrate on all the wrong levels, like Bill Gates and Klaus Schwab, are meant to terrify you into submission. Now, they need to terrify you into submission because, all things being equal, their victory is far from certain. Do you understand? They need this factor of you not resisting by thinking that they have this whole thing planned out and it's unstoppable, so that you're just thinking, am I going to live in the Andes? Am I going to, you know, should I not have children? Should I just end it now? I mean, honestly, they've got people up on this level. The suicide rates during the lockdown were phenomenally high. All of that was a crime against humanity. Now, we resist and we find success in resisting. And therein lies the victory. Therein lies even the justice. Don't think about, oh, these people are going to be perp walked or something, or something. They're in Gitmo. This is a clone. Don't think in these ludicrous terms. They will generally, I hope not, and keep pushing until they do, but they will generally avoid prosecution. But let me say something, and people who are older and our audience will understand this very well. I've lived my life like this is my second chance. I live my life like I've lived to be 90 years old, 100 years old, and I was born again to appreciate every moment, to embrace every person that I meet, to live in the now, to live in the present, to not fixate on attachments of the past or neurotic worries about the future, to plan and to be thoughtful and strategic, but to live in the present and to honor and cherish every moment I have alive, because life is very short. It's just as long as it needs to be. But don't worry about whether these absolute criminals are going to face justice at our hands. This entire created reality is a giant justice system. And the vast majority of your existence is not in this plane. This is a preparatory school for the afterlife. And one of the major coup d'etat of the elite against humanity was to promote and perpetrate this crime of conducting a giant illusion that and cutting entirely against the scientific evidence and gerrymandering results and narrowly defining the definition of science so that it is circularly, as a premise, only focused on answers that treat causes and outcomes as unconscious. Consciousness, they call supernatural, while recognizing that each of us experiences consciousness, and they can't really explain where that comes from, and they still can't explain where it comes from, which is why it's completely artificial and really just talking their book and promoting their, in analogy, their stock value at the World Economic Forum when Harari comes out and says the human being is entirely hackable and there is no soul. They wouldn't say those things if they were really true. They don't need to sell anybody this stuff if it's true. They don't need to be all scary and come out like this if you didn't need to be intimidated. And they need to intimidate you because, all things being equal, they don't win this fight. We will survive this, and their great reset plans will not succeed. And they will probably escape justice in this tiny little blip of mortality. And the afterlife and the hereafter, you know, God bless them. I think that the toll booths, you know, I'm no one, you know, when I leave this place, no one's going to ask me about what Bill Gates did. So I'm only saying this in terms of, it's not my focus. My salvation is not contingent on the fact that other people are worse. Okay, I am my own biggest problem. But Bill Gates and Harari and Schwab, as I will have answering to do, you know, I would imagine that they will have answering to do, unless, you know, one of them may have some sort of, you know, road to Damascus moment, and God bless them, and let's pray that they will. I'm sure that Stephen Protomartyr, very surprised to see Saul of Tarsus. In the afterlife. Now, to understand Foucault's contribution, again, is not to say that he was a co-conspirator, but knowledge itself is power, and knowledge is a tool, and anyone can use those tools. And so the elites have understood and dug into Foucault's research, and maybe his intentions were bad. Maybe the whole framework is that the intentions are good. It's a completely academic analysis of the questions are good questions when it comes to discipline. I mean, what is justice? And not in the sense that. Not in the sense that Plato recounts Socrates' dialogue on Justice, was it with Thrasymachus? I'm a little rusty. It's been a while. But rather, what are the motivations that people revel in witnessing justice? Do we put people, is it, when we see someone get punished, is it because we're happy that they're off the street when they to go to jail because other people will be safe? Is it because, whether we're happy or not, it is because other people will be safe and they're going to be not able to harm other people? Or is it because they are going to experience pain? Do we revel in their experience of pain? And do we revel in their experience of pain because we are projecting outwards from ourselves that we're kind of purging in this sympathetic way our own sins? Do we deny our own sins? Do we feel less guilty about our wrongs when we punish other people? I mean, we can go on and on. It's very complex. Now, people who experienced the lockdown began to say, like, hey, they are using this pandemic to justify creating a prison. And this must be some new idea. Like, they must have figured out that they actually want to put us on lockdown, which is a prison term. The term lockdown is from prison. That's what's crazy about this. Everyone on lockdown in, you know, Sector 4, on the third floor, are they on lockdown? Check the cameras. Check the buttons. The term comes from that. But what people don't know is that the modern system of prisons comes from lockdowns, from quarantines, at least as far back as the 17th century. And that is one of the focuses and the subject of Michel Foucault's work in Discipline and Punish, The Birth of Prison. He's looking at the birth of prisons. And so we have in chapter, Generalized Punishment, The Spectacle of the Scaffold, The Body of the Condemned, Generalized Punishment, we said, The Gentle Way in Punishment, Docile Bodies, next chapter. Docile Bodies, The Means of Correct Training, come on book, Panopticism. So the Panopticon, people will know, mentally ill man named Jeremy Bentham, who was considered a philosopher and a social theorist. You can see, just incidentally, you can see where in post-Protestant, you know, secular, post-Protestant utilitarian thinking about what is good, you'll see how the English philosophy entirely, this is of course during the high period of the British Empire, during the height of maximum power of the British Empire. There had just been, I guess, this uprising in the colonies, but there would be the War of 1812, which would probably restore some high degree of power of Britain over the US, the Empire. And then there, you know, you had the Raj in India, the British Raj, was still going strong, and you had many other. And that was really the jewel in the crown of the British Empire. And so Jeremy Bentham was a man absent morality, and yet was a moral philosopher. And he proposed a system of prison called the Panopticon, where all the prisoners effectively are policing each other and believe that by using like double-sided glass or tinted glass, they believe that the guard is watching them all the time. And the arrangement is like a circle of all the cells that are open facing the guard tower, but the guard tower is just glass on all sides. It's like a tinted glass. It was a, you know, technique which already existed. Sunglasses already existed. It was like a double-sided mirror, even maybe. And the guard would be in there or not. And so you always had to behave. But also, as some technocrat neo-fascist who pretend to be invited. This is when I show the receipts on stuff, you're going to be not surprised, but also horrified of what is actually allowed in the mainstream academic discourse. They're building upon the Panopticon. This is all part of the Great Reset agenda and smart cities as a Panopticon. 15% more efficient without, fuck you, without looking at planned obsolescence or human dignity. You're going to put everyone into a 300 square foot apartment with 5'10" ceilings to reduce building costs that with little 10-inch wide windows, maybe one window, so that the you don't waste all of your energy allotment on cooling or heating. You might be able to take a shower once a week. The Panopticism chapter, he exposes actually that prisons come from the plague. He says, the following, according to an order published at the end of the 17th century, were the measures to be taken when the plague appeared in a town. First, a strict spatial partitioning, the closing of the town and its outlying districts, a prohibition to leave the town on pain of death. This is what appeared, this is from the 17th century. He's describing, he's analyzed these documents on the protocols for one of the great plagues of the 17th century. It was across Europe, which appeared in a town. First, a strict spatial partitioning, the closing of the town and its outlying districts, a prohibition to leave the town on pain of death, the killing of all stray animals. You're going to hear so many things that are familiar to you. The division of the town into distinct quarters, each governed by an intendant. Each street is placed under the authority of a syndic who keeps it under surveillance. If he leaves the street, he will be condemned to death. On the appointed day, everyone is ordered to stay indoors. It is forbidden to leave on pain of death. The syndic himself comes to lock the door of each house from the outside. He takes away the key with him and hands it over to the intendant of the quarter. The intendant keeps it until the end of the quarantine. Each family will have made its own provisions, but for bread and wine, small wooden canals are set up between the street and the interior of the houses, thus allowing each person to receive his ration without communicating with the supplier and other residents. Meat, fish, and herbs will be hoisted up into the houses with pulleys and baskets. If it is absolutely necessary to leave the house, it will be done in turn, avoiding any meeting. Only the intendants, syndics, and guards will move about the streets and also between the infected houses. From one corpse to another, the crows, who can be left to die, These are people of little substance who carry the sick, bury the dead, clean, and do many vile and abject offices. It is a segmented, immobile, frozen space. Each individual is fixed in his place. And if he moves, he does so at the risk of his life, contagion, or punishment. Inspection functions ceaselessly, the gaze of alert everywhere. A considerable body of militia, commanded by good officers and men of substance, guards at the gates, at the town hall, and in every quarter to ensure the prompt obedience of the people and the most absolute authority of the magistrates. Quote, as also to observe all disorder, theft, and extortion, end quote. At each of the town gates, there will be an observation post at the end of each street, sentinels. Every day, the intendant visits the quarter in his charge, inquires whether the syndics have carried out their tasks, whether the inhabitants have anything to complain of. They, quote, observe their actions, end quote. Every day, too, the syndic goes into the street for which he is responsible, stops before each house, gets all the inhabitants to appear at the windows. Those who live overlooking the courtyard will be allocated a window looking onto the street at which no one but they may show themselves. He calls each of them by name, informs himself as to the state of each and every one of them, quote, in which respect the inhabitants will be compelled to speak the truth under pain of death, end quote. If someone does not appear at the window, the syndic must ask why. In this way, he will find out easily enough whether dead or sick are being concealed. Everyone locked up in his cage, everyone at his window, answering to his name and showing himself when asked, it is the great review of the living and the dead. This surveillance is based on a system of permanent registration. Reports from the syndics to the intendants, from the intendants to the magistrates or mayor. At the beginning of the lockdown, the role of each of the inhabitants present in the town is laid down, one by one. This document bears the name, age, sex of everyone, notwithstanding his condition. A copy is sent to the intendant of the quarter, another to the office of the town hall, another to enable the syndic to make his daily roll call. Everything that may be observed during the course of the visits, deaths, illnesses, complaints, irregularities, is noted down and transmitted to the intendants and magistrates. The magistrates have complete control over medical treatment. They have appointed a physician in charge. No other practitioner may treat. No apothecary prepared medicine. No confessor visit a sick person without having received from him a written note, quote, to prevent anyone from concealing and dealing with those sick of the contagion unknown to the magistrates, end quote. The registration of the pathological must be constantly centralized. The relation of each individual to his disease and to his death passes through the representatives of power, the registration they make of it, the decisions they take on it. 5 or 6 days later, after the beginning of the quarantine, the process of purifying the houses one by one is begun. All the inhabitants are made to leave. In each room, the furniture and goods are raised from the ground or suspended from the air. Perfume is poured around the room. After carefully sealing the windows, doors, and even the keyholes with wax, the perfume is set alight. Finally, the entire house is closed. While the perfume is consumed, those who have carried out the work are searched as they were on entry. Quote, in the presence of the residents of the house to see that they did not have something on their persons as they left that they did not have on entering, end quote. 4 hours later, the residents are allowed to re-enter their homes. This enclosed, segmented space, observed at every point, in which the individuals are inserted in a fixed place, in which the slightest movements are supervised, in which all events are recorded, in which an uninterrupted work of writing links the center and periphery, in which power is exercised without division, according to a continuous hierarchical figure, in which each individual is constantly located, examined, and distributed among the living beings, the sick and the dead. All this constitute a compact model of the disciplinary mechanism. The plague is met by order. Its function is to sort out every possible confusion, that of the disease, which is transmitted when bodies are mixed together, that of the evil, which is increased when fear and death overcome prohibitions. It lays down for each individual his place, his body, his disease, and his death, his well-being, by means of an omnipresent and omniscient power that subdivides itself in a regular, uninterrupted way, even to the ultimate determination of the individual. of what characterizes him, of what belongs to him, of what happens to him. Against the plague, which is a mixture, discipline brings into play its power, which is one of analysis. A whole literary fiction is of the festival grew up around the plague, suspended laws, lifted prohibitions, the frenzy of passing time, bodies mingling together without respect, individuals unmasked, abandoning their statutory identity, and the figure which they had been recognized, allowing a quite different truth to appear. But there was also a political dream of the plague, which was exactly its reverse. Not the collective festival, but strict divisions. Not laws transgressed, but the penetration of regulation into even the smallest details of everyday life through the mediation of the complete hierarchy that assured the capillary functioning control of power. Not masks that were put on and taken off, but the assignment to each individual of his true name and his true place, his true body, his true disease. The plague as a form at once real and imaginary of disorder had its medical and political correlative discipline. Behind the disciplinary mechanisms can be read the haunting memory of contagions, of the plague, of rebellions, crimes, vagabondage, desertions, people who appear and disappear, live and die in disorder. If it is true that the leper gave rise to rituals of exclusion, which to a certain extent provided the model for and general form of the great confinement, then the plague gave rise to disciplinary projects, rather than the massive binary division between one set of people and another. It called for multiple separations, individualizing distributions, an organization in depth of surveillance and control, an intensification and a ramification of power. The leper was caught up in a practice of rejection, of exile enclosure. He was left to his doom in a mass among which it was useless to differentiate. Those sick of the plague were caught up in a meticulous tactical partitioning in which individual differentiations were the constricting effects of a power that multiplied, articulated, and subdivided itself. The great confinement on the one hand, the correct training on the other. The leper and his separation, the plague and its segmentations. The first is marked, the second analyzed and distributed. The exile of the leper and the arrest of the plague do not bring with them the same political dream. The first is that of a pure community, the second that of a disciplined society. Two ways of exercising power over men, of controlling their relations, of separating out their dangerous mixtures. The plague-stricken town traversed throughout with hierarchy, surveillance, observation, writing, the town immobilized by the functioning of an extensive power that bears in a distinct way over all individual bodies. This is the utopia of the perfectly governed city. The plague, envisaged as a possibility at least, is the trial in the course of which one may define ideally the exercise of disciplinary power. In order to make rights and laws function according to pure theory, the jurist places himself in imagination in the state of nature. In order to see perfect disciplines functioning, rulers dreamt of the state of plague. Underlying disciplinary projects, the image of the plague stands for all forms of confusion and disorder, just as the image of the leper, cut off from all human contact, underlies projects of exclusion. They are different projects, then, but not incompatible ones. We see them coming slowly together, and it is the peculiarity of the 19th century that it applied to the space of exclusion of which the leper was the symbolic inhabitant, beggars, vagabonds, madmen, and the disorderly formed the real population. The technique of power proper to disciplinary partitioning. Treat lepers as plague victims. Project the subtle segmentations of discipline onto the confused space of internment, combine it with the methods of an analytical distribution proper to power, individualize the excluded, but use procedures of individualization to mark exclusion. This is what was operated regularly by disciplinary power from the beginning of the 19th century in the psychiatric asylum, the penitentiary, the reformatory, the approved school, and to some extent, the hospital. Generally speaking, all the authorities exercise individual control function according to some double mode, that of binary division and branding, mad, sane, dangerous, harmless, normal, abnormal, and that of coercive assignment, of differential distribution, who he is, where he must be, how he is to be characterized, how he is to be recognized, how a constant surveillance is to be exercised over him in an individual way, etc. On the one hand, the lepers are treated as plague victims. The tactics of individualizing disciplines are imposed on the excluded. And on the other hand, the universality of disciplinary controls make it possible to brand the leper and to bring into play against him a dualistic mechanisms of exclusion. The constant divisions between the normal and the abnormal, to which every individual is subjected, brings us back to our own time by applying the binary branding and exile of the leper to quite different objects, the existence of a whole set of techniques and institutions for measuring, supervising, and correcting the abnormal brings into play the disciplinary mechanisms to which the fear of the plague gave rise. All the mechanisms of power, which even today are disposed around the abnormal individual to brand him and to alter him, are composed of those two forms from which they distantly derive. Jeremy Bentham's panopticon is the architectural figure of this composition. We know the principle on which it was based. At the periphery, an annular building, at the center, a tower. This tower is pierced with wide windows that open onto the inner side of the ring. The peripheric building is divided into cells, each of which extends the whole width of the building. They have two windows, one on the inside, corresponding to the windows of the tower. The other, on the outside, allows the light to cross the cell from one end to the other. All that is needed, then, is to place a supervisor in a central tower and to shut up in each cell a madman, a patient, a condemned man, a worker, or a schoolboy. By the effect of backlighting, one can observe from the tower, standing out precisely against the light, the small captive shadows in the cells of the periphery. They are like so many cages, so many small theaters, in which each actor is alone, perfectly individualized and constantly visible. The panoptic mechanism arranges spatial unities that make it possible to see constantly and to recognize immediately. In short, it reverses the principle of the dungeon, or rather of its three functions, to enclose, to deprive of light, and to hide. It preserves only the first and eliminates the other two. Full lighting and the eye of a supervisor capture better than darkness, which ultimately is protected. Visibility is a trap. To begin with, this made it possible, as a negative effect, to avoid those compact, swarming, howling masses that were to be found in places of confinement, those painted by Goya or described by Howard. Each individual in his place is securely confined to a cell, which he is seen from the front by the supervisor, but the side walls prevent him from coming into contact with his companions. He is seen, but does not see. He is the object of information, never a subject in communication. The arrangement of his room, opposite the central tower, imposes on him an axial visibility, but the divisions of the ring, though separated cells, imply a lateral invisibility, and this invisibility is a guarantee of order. If the inmates are convicts, there is no danger of a plot, an attempt at collective escape, the planning of new crimes for the future, bad reciprocal influences. If they are patients, there is no danger of contagion. If they are madmen, there is no risk of their committing violence upon another. If they are school children, there is no copying, no noise, no chatter, no waste of time. If they are workers, there are no disorders, no theft, no coalitions, none of those distractions that slow down the rate of work, make it less perfect, or cause accidents. The crowd, a compact mass, a locus of multiple exchanges, individualities merging together, a collective effect, is abolished and replaced by a collection of separated individualities. From the point of view of the guardian, it is replaced by a multiplicity that can be numbered and supervised. From the point of view of the inmates, by a sequestered and observed solitude. Hence, the major effect of the panopticon to induce in the inmate a state of conscious and permanent visibility that assures the automatic functioning of power, so to arrange things that the surveillance is permanent in its effect, even in its discontinuousness in its action, that the perfection of power should tend to render its actual exercise unnecessary, that this architectural apparatus should be a machine for creating and sustaining a power relation independent of the person who exercises it. In short, that the inmates should be caught up in a power situation of which they are themselves the bearers. To achieve this, it is at once too much and too little that the prisoner should be constantly observed by an inspector. Too little, for what matters is that he knows himself to be observed. Too much, because he has no need, in fact, of being so. In view of this, Bentham laid down the principle that power should be visible and unverifiable. Visible, the inmate will constantly have before his eyes the tall outline of the central tower from which he is spied upon. Unverifiable, the inmate must never know whether he is being looked at any one moment, but he must be sure that they may always be so, in order to make the presence or absence of the inspector unverifiable, so that the prisoners in their cells cannot even see a shadow. Bentham envisaged not only Venetian blinds on the windows of the central observation hall, but on the inside, partitions that intersected the hall at right angles, and in order to pass from one quarter to the other, not doors, but zigzag openings, for the slightest noise, a gleam of light, a brightness, and a half-open door would betray the presence of the guardian. The panopticon is machine for dissociating the see-being, seen dyad. In the peripheric ring, one is totally seen without ever being seen, without ever seeing. In the central tower, one sees everything without ever being seen. It is an important mechanism, for it automatizes the disindividualizes power. Power has its principle not so much in a person as in a certain concerted distribution of bodies, surfaces, lights, gazes, in an arrangement whose internal mechanisms produce the relation in which individuals are caught up. The ceremonies, the rituals, the marks by which the sovereign surplus power was manifested are useless. There is a machinery that assures dissymmetry, disequilibrium, difference. Consequently, it does not matter who exercises power. Any individual taken almost at random can operate the machine. In the absence of the director, his family, his friends, his visitors, even his servants. Similarly, it does not matter what motive animates him. The curiosity of the indiscreet, the malice of a child, the thirst for knowledge of the philosopher who wishes to visit this museum of human nature, or the perversity of those who take pleasure in spying and punishing. The more numerous those anonymous and temporary observers are, the greater the risk of the inmate being surprised and the greater his anxious awareness of being observed. The panopticon is a marvelous machine which, whatever use one may wish to put it to, produces homogeneous effects of power. Now, this continues at some considerable length, but as you were listening, you no doubt felt and heard many of the aspects of the surveillance state in which you live. And so rather than needing the physical construction of a panopticon in terms of its mechanical distribution of the architecture surrounding a control tower, you have a computer and Google and a cell phone that tracks your every move. Everybody knows what you like. They know when you're home and when you're away. And then the vaccine passport is absolutely this individualized segmentation of society into each individual case. What does your PCR test say? Was it an antigen test? Are you single vaxxed or quadruple vaxxed? When were you last tested? How long were you on quarantine? Do you have your documents that you are now back from quarantine? To enter the store, you must present a document. It must say whether you have been vaccinated or whether you had tested negative or both in order to get on a plane, in order for your therefore all of your movements are tracked. They are regimented. They are categorized, qualified. All of these things continue on this way. It is precisely this understanding of how the plague was used as the dream of tyrants. The justification to regiment and record as if a massive census being conducted 24 hours a day, where all the data is streaming through a massive bureaucracy where all of the human efforts of this bureaucracy divert the efforts of the human being into a totalizing machine creation, where human efforts are sucked into, away from life and into a machine which takes on characteristics of life, but whose only aim is to regiment, divide, segmentize, and control. That is the project of the fourth industrial revolution and the smart cities. This has been out in the open, but they were very intelligent in one respect, in priming the public. But you can see that there are rejections of this. They had hoped to create a sort of moral play, a problem reaction solution. They were frustrated by the rise you
Thank you.